Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. It's the first week of March, and on this edition of The Bridge, we'll visit Southern Oregon with Jefferson Public Radio's correspondent, Bill McLean. The state of Idaho may be getting its first medical school within the next 2 years. And we'll hear about a study that supports what your mother always told you. Don't sit too close to the screen or you'll ruin your eyes. We begin with the first of two features this morning from Northwest News correspondent Anna King. At the Northwest's only nuclear power plant, a recent anonymous letter has spurred a $150,000 and growing investigation into the plant's performance. The letter was penned by an apparent insider, and now it appears the plant's executive board members will expand the investigation's scope. Anna says it's likely the probe will dig into employee safety culture.
Safety culture basically means, do employees at the very highest or the lowest levels feel comfortable to bring forward questions without fear of paybacks? The thought is, it's often employees closest to the work or the working parts of a plant that might spot a problem first.
Energy Northwest is the company that runs the power plant. A spokesman for the company said the employees are encouraged to contact federal regulators and that they can speak to managers or write to the company's board. Two investigators from a Washington, D.C.-based law firm have been at the nuclear power plant for days conducting interviews and requesting stacks of documents. Two more investigators are going through records in D.C. Now some of the plant's executive board members are asking the law firm to plan a phase two of the investigation. The D.C.-based law firm Pillsbury is expected to bring some initial results from their investigations to an Energy Northwest board meeting in March. More information about the safety culture might not be available until April or May. So far, the investigation is costing Energy Northwest $150,000, but that number is anticipated to grow with the possible go-ahead of Phase 2 of the investigation. Also, subcommittee members said on a call on Monday that if initial findings indicated problems, there might be a more detailed look or investigation into certain work groups or subsets of employees. Energy Northwest spokesman Mike Paoli said this is the first investigation of employee concern that's arisen to this level of scrutiny in the nuclear plant in at least a decade. Our next story involves some ecological pushback between the state of Washington and our neighbors to the north. Under a budget proviso passed recently by the Washington House of Representatives, Washington state government workers would be forbidden to travel to Victoria, British Columbia on business. The proposed travel ban is meant to pressure Victoria to stop dumping raw sewage into shared border waters.
Victoria is the only major West Coast city without a sewage treatment plant. British Columbia's capital region flushes millions of gallons of raw sewage into the Strait of Juan de Fuca every day. Washington state officials have complained about this for more than 20 years. State Representative Jeff Morris proposed a public sector travel boycott to signal that Victoria's neighbors are tired of waiting for a solution.
It's more symbolic than it is impactful, but I think it's important because every time Victoria's had a lot of international scrutiny about them dumping raw sewage, they've started to move more quickly.
Over the weekend, Victoria's mayor pleaded for a little more patience amid signs of progress. She says the Capital Regional District is scheduled to select a preferred option for sewage treatment and seek federal funding by the end of March. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
For much of this winter, Residents of Ashland in southern Oregon have heard the daily chop, chop, chop of helicopters making hundreds of trips over the hills just outside town. It's part of a project to thin the nearby forest of smaller trees and brush that could fuel a destructive wildfire. In keeping with the goal of ecosystem restoration, foresters are using the helicopter to remove cut timber rather than dragging fallen trees across the forest floor. From Jefferson Public Radio, Bill McLean reports.
On nearly any quiet morning these last few months, distant rotor blades echo and fade as a logging helicopter bops up and down between the mountain ridges above Ashland. Pilot Ricky Moore of Timberline Helicopters, Inc. says, "It's not dangerous to fly among the treetops with a long cable dangling underneath you if you know what you're doing."
You really don't think about it. You flow with it and you throw the hook out in front of you and you chase it down to the guy and you keep your eyes on the guys and you're always looking back up at the instruments. You're looking out the window at the trees around you to make sure you got rotor separation from them.
It's fast, repetitive, and precise work to maneuver into place a 200-pound hook suspended on a long cable for the ground crew below. Sometimes he can hardly even see them.
Not real well, because it's a pretty thick canopy, but they have high-power little LED flashlights, and they'll shine it, and it flashes at me.
Is it underneath that big one? Oh, I see it.
And then I'll say, "Okay, I got your light," and then, boom, there I am.
All right, got a light, and gotcha. All right, 4748.
The ground crew steps back and gives the pilot room to toss the hook into place. You might think he hovers overhead and lowers the hook slowly, but you'd be wrong.
To come in high and then come down slow takes a lot of time. So we come down the hill at about 100 knots, and if I can get a bead on your position, I start slowing it down. And as I do that, the hook flies out underneath me, and so I'll throw it. And then as I can kind of guess where you are, I'll come right over the top of it. It'll stop, and then boop, right down into him.
Within seconds, the ground team moves in to attach that hook to a bundle of logs they'd already strapped together, and the helicopter carries the 2 to 3 ton payload to a nearby landing where the pilot gently lays the logs down. Every few minutes, all day long, the helicopter goes back and forth, so these guys do this dance maybe 200 times a day. Joshua Budziak is a supervisor with Ashland's nonprofit Lomakotsi Restoration Project. He says even though the timber is sold to the mill, the trees aren't harvested for their economic value, but because after a century of aggressive fire prevention, the forest is thick and overgrown.
We're leaving the biggest and best, any tree over 150 years old we're leaving, and we're thinning out these smaller ones that are going to be more of a problem in the future when we do get a fire in the Ashland watershed. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Lomakotsi manages the $6.5 million federal grant in the Ashland watershed for its partners, the City of Ashland, the Nature Conservancy, and the U.S. Forest Service. This is only one of several similar projects Lomakotsi manages across Oregon and Northern California, covering thousands of overgrown woodland acres. Executive Director Mark Obey says the rationale for the logging operation and ground cleanup is simple: to remove all the accumulated fuels and underbrush that could lead a small fire into the treetops, so the forest can resist or survive a wildfire with its ecosystem intact.
We're not going to be able to stop high-intensity fires everywhere. We can't fireproof the forest, but we can make the forest more resilient to fire and reduce that severity of fire where we choose to do that work.
Meanwhile, back at the landing, the logs are processed by a danglehead delimmer, a swiveling contraption, something like a mechanical dinosaur that sucks in whole trees on one side and spits out cut-to-measure logs on the other side in mere seconds. Lomakotsi's Joshua Budziak again.
That's the machine with the saw you see on it right there, so it's going to be measuring diameter and length. And that's a 35-foot log he cut off there, and this one's going to be shorter. And he can measure the top there. He's going to cut it off right at 6 inches.
And voila, the logs are piled and ready for loading onto trucks that get up there via Tolman Creek Road, which remains closed not far from town, as well as many of the area's recreational trails inside the 1,200-acre project area. Lomakotsi had hoped to reopen the roads and trails by the end of this month, but weather delays grounded operations more than expected this winter. The agency says the entire area should be reopened for public use sometime this spring. I'm Bill McLean reporting.
has just got a little easier this year with the aid of volunteer programs throughout Oregon. AARP and Creating Assets, Savings, and Hope Oregon, or CASH, are offering free face-to-face consultations throughout the tax season, mainly to help people with low incomes. Bill Ensign of AARP said the programs have been able to reach so many people in need of help with their taxes because of a common thread among their volunteers.
They, as a rule, like to help other people. They may not necessarily like to do income taxes. We do have some of those that love to do income taxes too, but generally it's because our people just want to help someone else.
Volunteers must pass a test ensuring they are qualified to help with tax returns, and the IRS requires another counselor check the quality of the return. Although volunteers can help with taxes dating back to 4 years, Ensign says they are not able to help with complicated returns. Last year, the programs were available at more than 140 sites across Oregon, including community centers and schools, and were even able to help people unable to leave their homes. According to Rob Justice of CASH Oregon, his organization conducted a survey a few years ago and found that volunteers helped people in over 100 different languages. He says it's important for his organization to make sure taxes aren't so intimidating.
There's always this kind of fear factor that exists there. We see that with low-income folks. We especially see that when we're working with people where English isn't their first language, or we have people that are new immigrants. They want to do the right thing.
It says people save on average more than $150 by using this free service. Last year, the program's 1,300 volunteers helped more than 83,000 Oregonians do their taxes. Idaho may have its first medical school in the next 2 years. Idaho Governor Butch Otter announced this week that a private for-profit school of osteopathic medicine will be built in Meridian in cooperation with Idaho State University. Adam Cotterell has more.
At the announcement, Otter stressed that what will be called the Idaho College of Osteopathic Medicine will be a public-private partnership. However, beyond the fact that the school will be built on the Idaho State University Meridian campus, none of the nearly dozen speakers made clear what else the state's role will be in that partnership. Most of them did say the school will go a long way toward alleviating Idaho's doctor shortage. Speaker of the Idaho House, Scott Bedke, said he was picturing a junior high student hearing the announcement and something clicking.
You know, as I was sitting here listening, that was what was exciting to me, to have a grandchild or a nephew. I think, I could be a doctor.
Osteopathic schools are easier to get into than MD schools, and the training is not as rigorous. But DOs are eligible for the same residencies as MDs. And one MD we spoke with says if they complete that training, DOs are generally considered as good as MDs. I'm Adam Cotterell in Boise, Idaho.
Oh, the sounds of spring right around the corner. In Northwest farm country, tiny blueberry buds are already starting to plump up, and sudden cold snaps could kill them. Northwest scientists are studying how low blueberries can go, temperature-wise, that is. Correspondent Anna King explains.
Heating a good-sized blueberry patch for 10 hours could cost around $3,000. That too many times? A big profit drag. So when to flip the switch is key. Scientist Gwen Hotzheitzel is freezing down hundreds of blueberry buds weekly. She razors a bud open to show me how many fruit starts survived the cold test.
So see how there's little circles of darker green?
Yeah, they're almost like half a size of a pinhead.
Well, when they're dead, they're little pinheads of brown.
Hoheitzel says 10 more years of data would make a useful real-time model for farmers. I'm Anna King in Prosser.
Oregon lawmakers are advancing a measure that would create a statewide tip line to report threats against schools. The Oregon House approved the measure last week, and Salem correspondent Chris Lehman has the details.
The idea is that in some cases, someone who intends to do harm tells a friend or relative ahead of time. Democratic Representative Ann Leininger says the tip line would give that person a way to report their concerns anonymously.
What this bill does is set up a way that we can help find out what people are thinking about so that if there's going to be an incidence of violence, we can step in and intervene before something bad happens.
The tip line is expected to cost the state about $1 million per year to operate. It's the second try for a school safety tip line in Oregon. A previous version was created in 2004, but was soon discontinued when a federal grant ran out. I'm Chris Slaman in Salem.
The earlier tip line was operated by the Oregon Department of Justice. The new tip line would be operated by the Oregon State Police. It would be funded at least through the end of the current budget cycle in June of 2017 if the bill is signed into law. The measure would allow the Oregon State Police to solicit funds, quote, from any source to operate the tip line in the future. The bill would also make it a crime to knowingly make it a false report of a threat to the tip line. It passed the Oregon House 58-0 and now heads to the Senate. Now, we're not going to say, we told you so, but Mother might have been right when she said you shouldn't sit so close to the screen because it will damage your eyes. Half the world's population will be nearsighted by 2050, up from a quarter of the population in 2000, according to a new study in the Journal of the American Academy of Ophthalmology. While Jay Knights, researcher in the ophthalmology department at the University of Washington, says genetics still play the biggest part in determining a person's vision, that alone doesn't explain such a large shift.
The amount of televisions, computers, tablets, smartphones, all those kinds of things have increased dramatically. And, you know, if you're inside studying all the time and playing computer games, that is the largest correlate.
Researchers aren't sure why screens affect eyesight. It's only clear that modernized countries have been working closer to screens, and at the same time, nearsightedness has increased. A National Institutes of Health study found nearsightedness increased in the United States by 66% between the 1970s and the 2000s. A similar trend has been going on in East Asia, where researchers say as many as 90% of school children are nearsighted. That wasn't the case for an indigenous people that Knights visited in Argentina. They live outdoors nearly their entire lives. Knights measured the frequency of nearsightedness in those people and found it virtually zero. Research suggests children spend more time outside to help prevent developing nearsightedness. Getting kids outside could hold the key for some people looking to reverse the nearsightedness trend in their children. Rod Nichols works with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and he concurs that getting out is a healthy thing for all parts of you, not just your eyes.
We certainly encourage people to get out and enjoy Oregon's outdoors, because I think for people who've lived here a long time, it tends to be something you overlook, you know, and Oregon is beautiful. There are so many varieties of landscapes out there.
In our final feature this morning, Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports on the efforts of state lawmakers to understand and perhaps restructure the cost of drugs in their state. Washington spends about $1 billion a year on prescription drugs. That's state and federal funds. The cost has been going up. Now some lawmakers are wondering if there's a way to drive a better bargain, or at least shed some new light on how drugs are priced.
If there's a villain in the world of prescription drug pricing, it's Martin Shkreli.
On the advice of counsel, I invoke my Fifth Amendment. Privilege against self-incrimination.
This is Shkreli testifying, or actually not testifying, before a congressional committee earlier this month. He was in the hot seat because as CEO of a drug company, he hiked the price of a drug used by pregnant women and HIV patients 5,000%. Congressman Elijah Cummings of Maryland took the opportunity to give Shkreli a stern lecture.
The way I see it, you can go down in history as the poster boy for greedy drug company executives, or you can change the system. Yeah, you.
Shkreli smirked but said nothing. Afterwards, he tweeted, "Hard to accept that these imbeciles represent the people in our government." A recent legislative hearing in Olympia on prescription drug pricing was less dramatic.
Thank you very much. With that, we'll proceed to the bill sponsor, Senator Ranker.
Democratic State Senator Kevin Ranker made the case for requiring drug companies to explain their pricing in annual reports to the state. He said it was about transparency, but the pharmaceutical industry weighed in against the idea. Priscilla Vanderveer is Deputy Vice President of Communications for the trade group Pharma.
The question is, the requirements that they're calling for, how will that ultimately help patients? How is that going to help patients afford their medicines? Is it because they're going to take this information and apply a price control?
It takes a complex flowchart to even begin to explain how prescription drug pricing works. It's a world of negotiated prices and back-end rebates. Standing between the patient and the manufacturer are a multitude of players. Depending on who the purchaser is, the cost for the same drug can vary wildly. And drugs are getting more expensive. To help explain some of why this is, we're going to meet two people on the front lines of prescription drug purchasing.
I'm Donna Sullivan. I'm the Chief Pharmacy Officer for the Washington Healthcare Authority.
I'm Dan Lessler. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at the Washington State Healthcare Authority.
Sullivan and Lessler say to understand what's happening with drug prices, you need to understand this moment in history. Basically, the way they see it is one drug era is over.
Like the generic cliff, like we've gone over the generic cliff and that era is gone.
In other words, Sullivan says, there just aren't that many new, cheaper generic drugs coming onto the market. At the same time, says Lessler, the era of specialty drugs is taking off.
I think for the first time, we're seeing very expensive, very effective medications that are directed toward a very large population.
These are drugs that treat common conditions like diabetes and high cholesterol. They can cost $15,000 a year. Priscilla Vanderveer with the pharmaceutical lobby acknowledges drug prices did spike in 2014, but she doesn't accept the idea of a generic cliff. In fact, she says another round of generics will hit the market in the coming years, creating another sort of cliff.
You know, what we call a patent cliff, where a number of drugs go off patent and become generics.
In addition, she says, cheaper alternatives to specialty drugs, known as biosimilars, should start to become available. For all the complexity of prescription drug pricing, there are some basic rules of the road, mostly set by federal law. Veterans Affairs gets the best price. Medicaid is next best. Everyone else negotiates their own price. Here's how that plays out in real life. Consider the diabetes drug Lantus. The VA price is $100. The Medicaid price after an additional rebate is $175. But the state of Washington pays nearly $250 after rebate for that same drug for state employees. Democratic State Senator Reuven Carlisle finds that outrageous.
The fact that taxpayers are getting a really great wholesale deal for a drug in one account, but getting taken to the cleaners for that same drug in another account is ridiculous.
This year, Carlisle introduced legislation to require state agencies to seek drug prices as low as or less than the VA price. His idea didn't advance, nor did the drug company reporting requirement proposal. But if there's one thing both sides seem to agree on, it's that in the future, pharmaceutical pricing might look very different. Instead of getting paid for every pill dispensed, drug companies may get paid based on how well that pill works to make a patient healthy. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
That's all the time we have for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We like hearing from you. Send your comments and questions to News One. That's NEWS and the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. Please put The Bridge in the subject line. And you can like us on Facebook. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. Join us next Thursday morning at 9 for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.